What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora, Nissan Bolivinaka, Talohani, and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl, and I hope you have had a great weekend. I appreciate your company as we kickstart off a brand new week. So today's show, we have victims speaking out about the misuse of AI and the increase of deepfake technology.
Somebody got my face and put, like, you know, sexy lingerie or something like that on and posted up on Facebook. How are you supposed to feel, you know? It's happening to everybody.
A multi-million dollar upgrade to Timor-Leste's airport means families are losing their homes.
Our hearts are broken because we are being taken away from this place. Our children all grew up on this land. To be forced out now, we are filled with such deep sadness.
And local Fijian cameraman has been nominated for an Emmy Award. Stay tuned for those stories and more. But before we start, we'd like to give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. With that, I say mahalo nui loa. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with experts warning of increasingly sophisticated deepfake technology, putting women and children across the Pacific at greater risk of abuse. Papua New Guinea has begun drafting new laws to protect people from the harmful misuse of AI, including deepfakes, voice cloning and digital impersonation. But as Natasha Emick reports, victims say legislation alone won't be enough. They argue community awareness will be just as important if the reforms are to make a real difference.
Jennifer Bang built a large online following promoting sustainable farming in PNG. Now, her identity is being hijacked by scammers using AI-generated deepfakes.
I've seen one set of photographs that somebody got my face and put, like, you know, sexy lingerie or something like that on and posted up on Facebook. How are you supposed to feel, you know? It's happening to everybody.
She says she's found almost 100 fake Facebook accounts using her identity, most designed to scam people.
People clone whatever you've been doing on the internet, whether it's videos or photographs, and then what they've been doing is just making all these fake accounts. Our photos are being abused and our, you know, public standing is being abused by these scammers, these impersonators.
AI-manipulated images of Jennifer were used to promote fake giveaways, asking people to send money for a chance to win thousands of kina.
I'm concerned about my safety as well, because if that person's really scammed someone out of a lot of money, they're going to come after me, you know? And so my personal safety is also at risk.
She thinks much more community awareness is needed down to the village level, so people understand how AI can be used to deceive.
We have to run awareness in communities where people aren't educated enough to understand what exactly it is. Election time coming up, so don't believe anything that anybody shows to you, because this is what AI technology is. This is what it can do to your photo. You know, they could do this to your daughter. They could do this to one of your family members as well. So it's a real risk for the public now.
The PNG government announced last week it had begun drafting new laws to tackle the malicious use of AI, with plans to introduce the legislation when Parliament resumes in November. The proposed laws would include criminalising AI-generated sexual content, child exploitation material and fraudulent voice cloning. PNG's Assistant Commissioner of Police, Hodges Ethe, says police welcome the proposed changes to the Cybercrime Code Act, which will close existing gaps in the legislation.
In the last 5 years, there has been a serious increase.
It's a daily complaint. Not only at complaints been lodged at the Cybercrime Unit, it is also lodged at police headquarters and also in the provinces and the police stations.
But he says the country's small cybercrime unit is already struggling to keep up with demand.
Digital technology in Papua New Guinea is nationwide, and with 7 members of the cybercrime unit, that is insufficient.
To deal with it, police are now planning to shift less complex online offences to local police stations, allowing for specialist investigators to focus on more serious cases. He says many AI deepfake cases are already coming into them.
It has been reported. In fact, I personally had not last week, early this week, there was a photo of three girls in line holding each other, fully clothed. I saw that photo on the Facebook. A couple of days later, the same photo was provided with another photo replicating that photo, but this time the three girls were naked.
Mr. Ete says these crimes have serious psychological impacts on the victims.
I am aware of several instances where girls, particularly young women, have committed suicide. The level of stress mentally is so serious that we need such victims to also be put through psychological adjustment programs under the health systems that we have. It is frightening. I am a father of two girls. I'm always apprehensive when I open up Facebook.
Colm Gannon heads the International Centre for Missing and Exploited Children in Australia. He says the danger is often underestimated in the Pacific.
I think the risk that we have is that people do not think within the Pacific Islands and the regions is that it's going to affect their day-to-day sustainability, their day-to-day well-being. But realistically is that we're seeing AI becoming a commodity where young people, sometimes unknown to themselves, are being sexually exploited and being made vulnerable within the internet.
He says victims of digital exploitation are too often left without the support they need, and that must change alongside any new laws.
What we're hoping to do is that police and also law enforcement and regulators look at this from an empathetic point of view in relation to a victim-centric approach, work with technology companies to remove the material, and also incorporate support for victims and survivors of digital exploitation.
Assistant Commissioner Ete said there's still a lot more work ahead.
We need to do a lot more awareness, DICT, police, NICTA, maybe even the service providers, and to that effect, you know, Facebook.
He says joining the Budapest Convention, a global cybercrime treaty, will make it easier for PNG investigators to obtain digital evidence from overseas companies like Meta.
I'd like to put every Papua New Guineans on notice. Take care before you post anything on any social media platform. Use of AI and use of digital technology is no longer a fad. Whatever you put out there is seen worldwide.
And that is PNG's Assistant Commissioner of Police, Hodges Ete, ending that report from Natasha Emick. Also tonight, stay tuned because in about the next 20 minutes, we'll be talking with a community expert on AI and its influence over our Pacific languages. We head to Timor-Leste now, where it is pushing ahead with a major upgrade to its international airport. But the multi-million dollar expansion is facing a standoff with local residents. A recent Asian Development Bank report shows the project will impact nearly 250 households and businesses in Dili. While work has already begun, more than 50 families are refusing to move. They're alleging discrimination in the compensation process, claiming they have yet to receive a single cent for the land they call home. Timor-Leste reporter Vanya Vieira has the story from Dili.
Manuel Guterres first arrived at the land beside Dili Airport as a prisoner, as a Timorese resistance fighter during Indonesia occupation. He was captured in 1979 and taken to the notorious Marine Post.
When I came here during the Indonesian era, this land was empty and wild. The forces captured me in Lakluta and brought me here to this very spot. They punished me here. Then they ordered me to clear the land, to slash the bush and start planting bananas, trees and beans. That's why I live here.
He settled on the land, and for more than 40 years, this has been his home, where he raised a family and watched Timor-Leste finally win its independence. But now, as the Timor-Leste government moves ahead with an expansion of the international airport, he has been asked to leave. The expansion is part of a major redevelopment of President Nicolás Lobato International Airport, backed by more than 230 million Australian dollars from the ASEAN Development Bank and Japan. The project includes extending the runway, building a new air traffic control tower, and upgrading airport facilities. It's a development that Mr. Guterres is on board with. But he says he and more than 50 other households have been told the land where they live is state-owned land they won't be compensated for.
Whether the government gives more or less compensation for the land, I'd be fine with it. The country needs to be developed and we are ready to cooperate. But the government needs to show us a piece of land where we can live on. They come, they say this is state land, but that's impossible. I've lived here since I was young, I got married here, and now my grandchildren are living on this land. How can they say I have no rights to it?
Julie Da Silva is a lawyer with Rede Barai, an organization that advocates for land rights, especially in disputes between citizens and the state. He is representing Mr. Gutierrez and the other residents in a court case against the government, seeking recognition of the rights of their rights to the land and compensation before they are forced to leave.
The government claims the area held by these 57 households is state property. As a result, authorities are only offering to pay for the trees and houses impacted by the airport expansion, while refusing to compensate the families for the land itself.
Mr. Da Silva says the residents are not questioning the legal technicalities, but are instead deeply concerned about their future livelihoods and living conditions.
Currently, the community is rejecting the government's proposal to compensate only for trees and structures, as they say this directly threatens their ability to support themselves.
And he argues the state cannot ignore the social consequences of the expansion.
The government must find a solution. Since residents are losing their source of income, authorities must address this to prevent a negative impact on their lives. This is what the community is demanding. Ultimately, the residents strongly support development and the public interest.
The Minister of Justice, Sergio Hornay, says the all parties must abide by the court decision, and he insists that if the land is legally proven to be state property, the community must cooperate.
If the court rules that the land belongs to the state, then all parties must comply, as the ruling legally establishes and determines that the property is state-owned.
Minister Sejo says the project is in the public interest and that the expansion of the airport is a necessary step for the country.
The Ministry of Justice, through the Directorate of Land and Property, maintains that this project is for the collective good. The 57 affected households, whether voluntary or involuntary, must be prepared to cooperate so that the proper decision can be made according to the law. While everyone must comply, I want to emphasize that, voluntary or not, the expansion of the airport is necessary and must proceed.
In Manuel Gutierrez's backyard, his wife Merlinda used to grow vegetables to sell, using the income to pay for her children's school fees. She says she is devastated at the idea of leaving the home that once provided for her family.
Our hearts are broken because we are being taken away from this place. Our children all grew up on this land. To be forced out now, we are filled with such deep sadness.
Marina is scared of how they will make an income if she has to leave. And while she is ready to cooperate with the government, she insists that when the time comes for them to leave, they should be able to do so with a sense of peace and fairness.
If we move to a new place, we will have to start all over again to make the land fertile. I am old now. What else can I do to provide for my children and my grandchildren?
And that is Dili resident Melinda Gutierrez ending that report from Vonia Vieira in Timor.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Me Taki Mata, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Australia has offered stronger support for a regional security pact across the Pacific in the wake of a Chinese ballistic missile test last week. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Matthew Wiley has been seeking support for the idea ahead of a meeting of leaders of the Pacific Islands Forum next month. Mr. Wiley has pointed to the missile test as strengthening the case for a regional security pact. Minister for Pacific Island Affairs Pat Conroy says China's actions has damaged its standing in the region and Australia would support a regional security pact.
Well, I think it demonstrates again that the Pacific security can only be provided by from within the Pacific. That's the essence of leaders' communiques over a number of Pacific Island forums. And we're up for that conversation. The policy of the Albanese Labor government in the Pacific is we turn up, we listen to the priorities of Pacific leaders and we act on them. Mm. And that's why we've got two more alliances than we did a couple of years ago. That's why our standing in the region has improved massively. Australia is now safer and more secure because of the actions of Prime Minister Albanese in the Pacific
this week.
So
just to be clear, this regional,
over the last 4 years,
this idea for a regional security agreement, are you actively working towards it now?
Well, we're up for it, but importantly, it needs to be driven by Prime Minister Wale, given he's the current chair of the Pacific Islands Forum, and he's the one
who says he does want to do that. What has he asked of Australia to try and accelerate it happening?
Well, again, I don't get into confidential discussions between governments. That's not how we engage in diplomacy. But Prime Minister Wale has said it's in the region's interest and he intends to pursue this at the PIF leaders summit coming up in late August. Mm. This would take a number of years if the rest of the Pacific was up for it. But ultimately, it's a decision of all the Pacific leaders. We act on a consensus approach. But importantly, we've now got an alliance that's come into effect with Papua New Guinea, an alliance we've signed with Fiji. We've signed landmark security treaties with Vanuatu, with the Nakamal, with Tuvalu, with Nauru. Australia has a range of treaties and agreements that mean that we're safer now than we were 4 years ago.
But would it, you say it's up to them to lead it. Is it in Australia's interest? Will you be going into that PIF, pushing for it to happen? Are you committed to it happening?
Well, it's in Australia's interest because it's consistent with both our policy in the Pacific, but the whole PIF approach, which is that if there's gaps in security within the Pacific should ask other Pacific nations to fill them. And that's the strong policy of the Albanese Labor government. That's why we've signed alliances and treaties with a range of governments. We're up for the conversation, but importantly, this should be driven by the Pacific leaders and the Pacific people.
But your message to the minister is we're on board, you drive it, but Australia's on board.
Absolutely, PK. That's a good summation of it. It would be consistent with our approach to individual countries. We're proud to be the security partner of choice for the Pacific, just as we are the development partner of choice. This is all about peace and stability in our region. Australia's peace and prosperity depends upon a stable, peaceful and prosperous Pacific, and we're working every day to engineer that.
And that's Pat Conroy, Pacific Island Affairs Minister, speaking to the ABC's Patricia Cavallis.
Pacific Beat.
Well, if you've been rugging up or busting out your jackets, keep them handy because the Pacific's cold weather spell will be around for a bit longer. Temperatures have been dropping across the region. Tonga just recorded its coldest day on record, 8.6 degrees Celsius, breaking a record that had stood since 1994. And speaking from Fiji, Neville Coop, the director of the Nindraki Weather Service, says the chilly weather is set to stay.
This time of the year through the June, July, August period is when it's coldest, in inverted commas, here in the tropical Pacific. And these sorts of really prolonged cold outbreaks are typically associated with the movement of high pressure and low pressure further south. Between that high pressure and the low pressure to the east, we have this very deep southerly airflow, and it's literally bringing sub-Antarctic air that's originating in the very cold waters north of Antarctica, south of New Zealand. And it's pushing that air northward across New Zealand and into the tropics. And what happens On that progress, that air is slowly warmed by the oceans beneath, but it becomes very dry, and certainly when it gets to Fiji, it's still quite cool.
You're in Nandi at the moment. What are some of the temperatures you're seeing there?
We had a minimum temperature in Suva of 14 degrees. Now, I've not seen temperatures, I think the coldest I've ever personally seen was 13, and that was in Nandi, probably in the late 90s. It's no one's freezing to death, but everyone's dressing warm. You certainly, this time of the year, the Fiji military has had a long history of peacekeeping in the Middle East, and everybody who's been over there gets issued winter clothing for the winter in the Middle East, and they bring it all back, and this time of the year they bust it all out. So you see a lot of people walking around in camouflage jackets and long pants that are army surplus that are left over from their time serving in the Middle East as a peacekeeper. Everybody's feeling it, and certainly the further south you are, the worse it is. It's a little milder up north towards Tuvalu and Kiribati, but yeah, it's noticeably cold but pleasantly dry, so we don't have any humidity.
And what do we know about how long this particular cold spell might last for?
Well, I've been asked that question several times, and my standard answer is until about October. So it's a sort of a cycle. It's just repeating itself over and over, and it's been doing that since crikey late May, and there's no sign of this letting up.
El Nino has been declared, and my understanding is that at the moment in certain parts of the Pacific, much drier. We're seeing perhaps some drought-like conditions being watched for. Does El Nino have anything to do with how this is playing out now, this dry, cold time?
It does in terms of exacerbating the levels of humidity, but it's not really having much effect in terms of actual temperatures, because currently the ocean temperatures, and let's face it, the Pacific is 99% ocean. The ocean temperatures are about a degree and a half to 2 degrees above average, long-term average, and they've been like that for a decade or more, and that's part of global warming. Now, the fact that we're getting this very cold weather would seem anomalous, but it's what the meteorologists we call advection, which is we're moving air from some other place to a different place, in this case from waters that are sort of bordering, fringing the Antarctic continent up into the tropics. And when you do that, you're going to bring that cold air up here. Now, if that conveyor stopped, we'd very quickly go back to the hot, humid, steamy weather that you expect in Fiji, in sort of different times of the year. But we get these setups of southerly wind quite vigorous. We've also had swells of about 3.5 meters. We've seen a lot of surfers coming to town. The surest way to know if the surf is good in Fiji is to count the number of private jets at the airport, because all the rich Californians fly down and go surfing. So there's about 4 or 5 parked on the tarmac. I spotted though, we know they're out there enjoying the great surf that comes with this southerly airflow. So it's going to continue for a little while yet. We might get a little bit of respite from the brutal cold in terms of relative to Fiji, but it's going to come back again with the next system probably mid to late next week again, and people will be busting out their puffer jackets and throwing an extra blanket on the bed and having to dress warm if they're out at night.
And that is Neville Coop, the director of the Nindaraki Weather Service, speaking to reporter Jordan Fennell.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on
on ABC Radio Australia.
Yes, now across the world, half of the 7,000 living languages are actually endangered. According to a report by Ethnologue, in Oceania alone, over 700 languages are endangered, of which Papua New Guinea accounts for more than 300. Now, with artificial intelligence or AI rapidly changing how we communicate, could it hinder or help the survival of our Pacific languages? To unpack this, on the line we have Lautile Schmidt-Gein, CEO and founder of the Va'a Collective in Aotearoa, which is an AI wayfinding framework that helps our Pacific communities navigate AI. With that, I say mālore soifua and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Ah, manuile te ao, whaftai mō lau anod, and talo whalawa.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eki, for inviting me.
Absolutely. Really appreciate you coming on the show this morning. Just before we do touch on AI, you know, as I mentioned in the intro, I'm just wondering, do you think, though, our Pacific languages are at risk of disappearing?
Most definitely, they are. And we have to do something about it, and we have to do it. We have to collectively do something about it, and it has to happen now.
Yeah. Well, then, how did you yourself, Lautile, like become involved with or within the world of AI?
Well, my business, I'm a founder of Va'a Collective. I'm Samoan, and my villages are Whalepuna, Vau, and Safutu. And I work in Pacific Māori and ethnic and communities across Aotearoa and New Zealand, helping people understand how to use artificial intelligence in practical and culturally safe ways. And, you know, in the way that our people want to be trained in that. I've been also supporting the Pacific Pediatric Association, so working alongside pediatricians and child health leaders across the Pacific through both roles. I've seen the opportunity that AI offers, but also the importance of protecting our languages, our cultures, and our knowledge as these technologies become part of everyday life. I was actually also a trainer in Melbourne in the late 80s as well. So it's really important that we're always making sure that our communities are up to speed with the technology that's really just getting thrown at us every day.
Mm. And that's the thing, maybe some of us or a lot of us from our Pacific community might have misperception or misconceptions about AI itself. But then for you, where do you think then AI fits into the efforts of keeping our Pacific languages alive?
Look, I think our people need to understand what AI is about, who owns it, where our data is going, and that is something that I actually cover in my training sessions. You know, it's all about data security, where it's going, and some fantastic models out there, blueprint models that are doing a wonderful job of retaining our language and actually keeping it safe. So, you know, you haven't got the likes of Silicon Valley's just coming and extracting all our, you know, our data and that. So, I really see the value in helping our people as well. I'm in communities teaching our people how to use AI in a way that works for them. You know, it's very different. Community and corporate and, you know, office is very different to our communities and that.
How practically then? How do you teach that to our more so maybe our elderly, those who find that, you know, there's a bit of a language barrier? How do you actually practically teach them to use AI responsibly?
Well, we have to actually understand, you know, who are they first? We have to actually look at our people and say, who are you and what's your needs? And, you know, my needs are very different from working in an office. Like I have people, I'm teaching people how to, you know, be able to budget on $150 and, you know, to feed their family and that. And I'm teaching them how to use AI to help them, you know, to search for where they can locate food and that. But also I'm using it in a way to help our doctors to get messages out to villages, remote villages that don't have access to internet. I've just been dealing with our doctors, our pediatricians in Vanuatu, where we've helped them to produce a colouring book for in Bislama and French and that for Vanuatu and that for our people, because there's nothing out there in that. But what I have done is I've actually dealt with the paediatricians. The information has come from the paediatricians. AI has helped with the illustrations of the colouring book, but the wording and the information has come from our doctors. And where I've actually had to put boundaries into the AI saying you're not to rewrite it or touch the text at all. So we have to start looking at things like that. And also Te Heku Media, they've put like a stewardship license. We need our people to, well, collectively, we all have a responsibility to help our Pacifica Islands and help them to look at ways of data sovereignty, to protecting our information. But we have to be the leaders of it, not Silicon Valley.
That brings up a really good point, though, when you're talking about us trying to preserve our language and understand AI and how that can happen. I'm wondering, though, if it is done wrong, though, how can AI actually hinder that preservation of our languages?
Well, for us, you know, when I teach AI, I am also bringing with that is my ancestral knowledge and also my spiritual knowledge in that, because that's who we are. That's who Pacifica, you know, that's who we are. But and AI can't do that. You know, it can extract the information and that, but it doesn't, you know, what it does is it doesn't understand the meaning. You know, because we have our cultural that comes with it. So they can extract it, but the meaning might be wrong, you know. So that's why we need to make sure we put our people in the hot seat, you know, actually driving our languages and, you know, keeping it safe and that.
Of course. Well, then, Lautile, what are your hopes for the future then when it comes to the use of artificial intelligence or AI, especially when it can have a great influence on the preservation of our language?
Yeah. I guess what gives me hope is our people. Pacific communities have always adapted to change while holding firmly onto who we are. I don't want to see us become passive users of AI. I want to see Pacific communities designing it, governing it, contributing our languages and our values and deciding how our knowledge is used. I also see opportunities well beyond language preservation. Community-led AI can improve health information, strengthen education, make government services easier to access and help protect our people from increasingly sophisticated scams and information. If we can put our culture first and our technology second, AI can become a powerful tool for strengthening our languages and improving the well-being of our communities.
Absolutely. Lautile, look, that's all the time that we have for this morning, but really great, some great insights there that you've offered for us this morning. I just want to say, faftai te le lava.
Faftai. Anuila aso, faftai agi.
That's Lautile Schmidt-Geen, CEO, founder of the Va'a Collective. It is an AI wayfinding framework that helps our Pacific communities navigate artificial intelligence right here on Pacific Beat.
Discover the stories that shape our region on Culture Compass. Travel across the Pacific with Afmasanga Sayuli Salamasina von Reiki as she traces the shift from oral traditions to online connections, explores the delicate balance between conservation and cultural practice, and follows the ukulele's journey across the islands. Culture Compass, a journey through resilience, revival, and deep connection. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nissan Bulivinaka, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. To sport now, a familiar figure is about to take charge of Fiji's national men's rugby league team, and with only less than 100 days to go before the 2026 World Cup. Currently an assistant coach with the Bulldogs in the NRL, Mick Potter led the Butsy to their most famous World Cup win over New Zealand back in 2017. In his own words, he describes himself as a more mature coach now, and he's keen to give it another shot. And Potter also sees a role for himself in bringing together the warring factions in Fiji Rugby League, the FNRL and the Kaiwiti Silktails. But first priority is the World Cup, and he's already been busy even before he signed on the dotted line.
I've been taking an interest in the last few months just because it's been sort of bubbling away. So just without any hands-on, I've actually been having a look at a few of the players that are running around, and we're probably as strong as we were 10 years ago, maybe a little bit stronger with our playing roster as far as candidates that are eligible for the Fiji Barty team.
Would you anticipate that the bulk, if not all, of the squad will come from the NRL, or could you see yourself drafting players in from the domestic game in Fiji?
Possibly Super League. Mike Asivo, I think, has been going exceptional over there with Leeds, and there might be a couple of others over there that might be under consideration. But yeah, I would imagine the bulk would be from the NRL.
It's fair to say, though, I think that in the last couple of years, the Fijian team has had a bit of a bumpy ride. I mean, they've had some notable victories, but they've also had some unwanted defeats. Do you feel that the side has more potential than perhaps it's been demonstrating in recent times?
There's probably circumstances around that, and I think some of their key players have been missing in those performances that they thought they should have done a little bit better. And that's primary to your team success, is having your best players available when the big tournaments are on. And right at the moment, I think we're coming into that phase where the World Cup's on and just about everyone is available right at the moment. So that's a good position, and I don't think that's been happening over the last couple of years. I think a couple of guys have had surgeries, a couple of guys have had niggly injuries and they needed the rest. So there's circumstances in behind, you know, some of the performances, and I think all the players, when they play for the Barty, they do give their best they possibly can.
You're now going to be working for the FNRL as head coach of the Barty, but in your role at the Bulldogs, I'm presuming you have a connection with the Silktails because they have an agreement with that club, as I understand it, and players have gone into the Bulldogs on trial basis and the like. I mean, does that make you a bit picky in the middle?
It's good to have relationships with clubs, and just working with the FNRL, I think, you know, just having that pathway, I think perhaps having that relationship does make it a little bit easier for players to assimilate into a new club. But I think, you know, I'll be pretty holistic in my view on, you know, how players are coming through with the pathways and make sure that there's quite a spread. And, you know, just once they get to a certain level, they want to do what they want to do, and that'll be solely up to the individual how they progress.
Do you think there might be a role for you to play in bringing the two sides together, the FNRL and the Silktails? Because they don't get on. They don't seem to like each other very much. And I would have thought that's not for the good of the game in Fiji.
I think that's true. And I'd like to think that I could mend whatever issues there are there, because we want a smooth pathway into the NRL. The more Fiji players we get through to the NRL, whether it's Silktails or the lower grades at other NRL clubs, the more players we get through, the better it is. We want that to happen. And for the bulk of them, I think that's probably the most logical thing, to bring them through the Silktails.
So could it be, therefore, that your focus, obviously, over the next 100 days or so will be on the build-up to the World Cup and the tournament itself, but thereafter, you might become the peacemaker?
We're all working for the one goal, to make Fiji Rugby League better in the local competition, as well as in the junior competition, as well as in the Fiji Barty. And the only way to do that is to work together.
And as far as the World Cup is concerned, it's pretty hard to look past 2017 and that remarkable game against New Zealand that Fiji won without actually scoring a try. Neither side scored a try. It was decided on goals 4-2, but it got Fiji into the semi-final that year. Is that the benchmark?
Probably over the last few years, it is for where we are. And there's a couple of guys that are still playing, will be in the World Cup team this year. And with the squad we're putting together, we just don't want to leave it at being happy with just getting in a semi-final. We're going in the competition to try and win it. Whether we can or not, that's another thing. But certainly that's our goal, to do our best. We've got certainly a lot of talented players, a lot of hard-working players that will give it a big shake.
And that's Mick Potter taking on the role of Fiji Barty head coach for the second time with the World Cup on the horizon. And Mick was talking to Richard Hewitt. Well, to Fiji, where local cameraman and cinematographer Lanza Coffin has earned international recognition for his work. Named as part of the camera team nominated for an Emmy Award, Coffin, who has worked for more than 15 seasons on the hit reality series Survivor, is up for the category Outstanding Cinematography for a Reality Program. What an achievement, and we are privileged to have him join us this morning. Yandra Lanza, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yandra, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Firstly, I have to say congratulations on such an achievement. I mean, how are you feeling right now?
It still hasn't quite sunk in. I mean, it's only been a couple of days, but still very excited and a little overwhelmed, to be honest.
I mean, I have to ask, what was your initial reaction when you found out you were pretty much part of the team being nominated for that Emmy Award?
I couldn't believe it. Like, I saw the email and I had to read it a couple of times for it to actually sink in. But, very excited.
Yeah, I'm so glad. Lanza, you've been in the industry for, I would say, 12 or more years. I mean, how did you actually get started in this field?
So I used to be a wedding photographer. That was probably the first moment I picked up a camera. I always knew that I wanted to be involved in everything tech, and especially with photography at the time. And then I got asked by a friend of mine if I wanted to join Survivor. Immediately said yes. I joined as a PA, what Survivor usually calls the dream team, and then did that for one season, and then moved over to the camera team in 2017, and then started operating a camera in 2019 and have been doing that ever since.
That is amazing. Look, I'm not too sure. I know with all our Pacific families, often being a photographer or being something in the arts isn't always the dream job, right? But obviously, did you have great support in the beginning there with the type of work you wanted to get into?
100%. It's always good to have a good support base, especially with this type of work. Survivor shoots, production for Survivor is about 6 months, so usually away from home for about 6 months. But with this type of show, you not only have the support from back home, but you also have a huge crew. Survivor's about 800 plus crew. So over the last 12. Well, I've been with Survivor for 10 years. Over the last 10 years, they've come to be somewhat part of my extended family. So it's been an amazing experience.
Can you maybe share some of the, if there were any challenges when working on such a big, massive international TV production?
One of the biggest things that you have to deal with, especially out here, is the environment that you shoot in. Because we shoot out in the islands, it's not the regular, you know, pack the truck and then just drive over to location and then you're all set to shoot. Most of the time we have to transfer gear to boats and then have to walk gear probably in a kilometer or two, unpack, shoot the challenge. And sometimes, especially during the cyclone season, we're doing this in cyclonic weather sometimes, massive rainstorms, having to deal with the elements out in the ocean. All of this not only is difficult, but it adds to the experience, and it's something that not so much look forward to, but it's something that we have to deal with every year.
And this is the thing, though. It being filmed, you know, sometimes in your homeland, of course, of Fiji, I'm just wondering, what sort of advantage do you think that brought into the Survivor team, you know, given your lived experience and Fijian heritage?
Mm-hmm. Well, so Survivor started off 25 years ago in the year 2000. And prior to coming to Fiji, they were shooting in different countries every year. Until they came to Fiji, they would have to teach crew about how they do things. Whereas now, ever since they first came here, the same crew that they've had from year one, majority of them are still there. So most of us that started off in 2016 onwards have basically learnt how they do things, and then quite a large majority of us have the necessary skills to take over from some of these international crew members.
Lanza, when we look at you know, the recognition that you've been given, what does this mean for even just the development of film or even production in Fiji there?
Well, it's huge. I mean, like, to be the first event of anything nationwide is a daunting thing in my mind. One, obviously, it's exciting and it's historic, but over the last couple of days, I've been getting messages and calls and stuff, and it sinks in that you also have a massive responsibility, because it shows, especially the young people and those that want to get into this industry, that it is possible. You're paving the way for them and showing them the way of how it could be done, and possibly done a little bit easier down the line. But with the film industry slowly gaining way more traction than when I first started, there's a lot of opportunity for Pacific Islanders, especially here in Fiji, to get into the industry. And it's definitely possible for us to put on international type productions here in Fiji. And it's a massive plus for the country as well.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking, you talked about responsibility, you know, especially when there's young people coming up. What advice then would it be, or that you would give to young people in Fiji wanting to get involved in this industry?
Well, I was one of those ones, especially in school, that didn't quite take to, you know, accounting and math and all the regular stuff. So I was also always interested in things. So my advice is, you know, if you have the skills outside of the norm of being an accountant or a doctor or whatever, you still have necessary skills that are quite relevant in the film industry. You're looking at artists, painters, woodworkers, chippies, electricians. All of these necessary skills are quite applicable in the film industry, and even in tech with sound and camera. If you just put your mind to it, I mean, I never went to school for camera work. I learned everything on the job. And hats off to Survivor. They gave me the opportunity to put a camera in my hands. So if you have the opportunity, just take it, put your head to the ground and do the hard yards, and who knows, maybe one day you'll find yourself on the stage in the Emmy Awards.
Of course, yes. And hey, that's some really great sound advice there, Lanza. And, you know, the most important question is, have you got your outfit sorted for the Emmy Awards?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure about that. Hopefully I do make it over. That's part of the plan. In a couple of months, hopefully I'm on a plane to LA. And definitely looking forward to it, because there's a mass, I didn't know about this, but like I said earlier, getting massive phone calls and messages, there's massive support, and I'm completely 100% grateful for all of it.
I'm sure you are. And look, we have to say congratulations again on your nomination. We really do look forward to seeing you on that red carpet. I just want to say vinaka for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you so much.
No worries. That is Fijian cameraman, cinematographer, and now Emmy Award nominee Lanza Coffin here on Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Now, Minister for Pacific Island Affairs, Pat Conroy, says China's actions has damaged its standing in the region, and Australia would support a regional security pact.
It demonstrates again that the Pacific security can only be provided by from within the Pacific. That's the essence of leaders' communiques over a number of Pacific Island forums.
And that is Minister for Pacific Island Affairs, Pat Conroy. Now, if you need to find that story, you can simply type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. We are across our social media platforms. You can check out our stories on Facebook or Instagram. But we'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily, which I must remind you, I catch up with them with the headlines at the half hour mark. So stay tuned for that. Until next time, Otoa Afato, you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.